The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode of the Lawfare podcast is brought to you by Grammarly. Thanks to Grammarly for supporting the Lawfare podcast. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently by going to grammarly.com/lawfare. That's grammarly.com/lawfare. to get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today.
The articles frame this conduct as ongoing. So it's less pointing to past action that deserves punishment and more saying, look, he did this in the past, he's doing it now, and he's gonna do it again. And this is a matter of urgency for that reason. Partially, they make this point by pointing to the fact that the Democrats argue that the Ukraine matter is an effort to swing the 2020 U.S. election. And so the argument goes, we can't just sit around and wait. You can't say, well, we should wait to have an election to deal with this problem, because that's like saying, let's play another round of cards with the person who you just found out is cheating.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 10th, 2019. We have articles of impeachment. We have a very long Inspector General report on the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane investigation, and we have a Lawfare Podcast that you will not want to miss. We have Margaret Taylor, we have Quinta Jurassic, we have Jack Goldsmith, and we have David Criss. We have really unparalleled expertise on these issues. We talk through them all. We start out by talking about the new articles of impeachment unveiled today, and then we do a deep dive on the Inspector General's investigation. We talk about where it vindicates the FBI. We talk about where it severely criticizes the FBI, and we talk about those very peculiar statements from the Attorney General and John Durham, the U.S. Attorney from Connecticut. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 483, Investigations All the Way Down. All right, let's start with articles of impeachment, which magically showed up today like Athena born from Zeus's head. Margaret, we've known since the story started leaking last night that there were going to be two of them, and one was going to be about abuse of power, and the other was going to be about obstruction of Congress as distinct from obstruction of justice. What do we need to know about, what's the more chapter and verse version of the two articles of impeachment that dropped today?
So there's nothing surprising there at all. The first article of impeachment is on abuse of power. And in that article is encapsulated essentially the Ukraine story, which is that the president abused his office, the office of the presidency, by essentially asking a foreign government to investigate his political rival, as well as holding up foreign aid and withholding a meeting in the White House. So that's sort of the Ukraine story is really embodied in In the first article. The second article of impeachment relates to, it's still essentially about the Ukraine story. It's about the president and the White House basically doing a full stonewall of directing people who were subpoenaed to testify to not provide any information, to provide no documents to the House investigators involved in the impeachment inquiry. That is the heart and soul of the second article of impeachment. What's interesting about it is what's really not in there. There's no article of impeachment related, for example, to obstruction of justice based on volume 2 of the Mueller report. There's nothing in there about emoluments. There's really nothing kind of extraneous in there. It's pretty streamlined. It's a very short document. It's just over 8 pages, and it's written in very, very clear terms. So, you know, it's clear they've made a pretty clear strategic choice to limit the articles to the Ukraine matter and to make it something that Americans can really understand.
And how do you, when you say they've made a clear choice, I mean, we've spent a good chunk of the day talking about the nature of the strategic choice here. A lot of people, and I count myself among them, are kind of disappointed that volume 2 of the Mueller report it doesn't show up at all. And there are reasons for that. So talk us a little bit through, if you're Nancy Pelosi, what are the factors that lead you to disappoint Ben Wittes and particularly Susan Hennessy, who, you know, wrote a piece last night, you know, saying this would be a big mistake. What are the factors that would lead you to say, okay, it's good of you, Ben Wittes and Susan Hennessy, to, you know, carry that particular flame, but the grown-ups here are going to really focus exclusively on Ukraine and not humor you on the Mueller stuff?
So I should actually revise my first answer a little bit. The Mueller report is alluded to in the articles of impeachment, actually in both of the articles. So in the first article, there's a little section that says, you know, Trump's efforts to extort Ukraine, quote, were consistent with President Trump's previous invitations of foreign interference in United States elections. And in the second article, which is the obstruction article, it makes a similar kind of note. It says these actions were consistent with President Trump's previous efforts to undermine United States government investigations into foreign interference in United States elections. So there are references to the Mueller report, but there's nothing based on the Mueller report. And I think that it is a clear, I think, political choice that's been made, probably most likely by Nancy Pelosi. The Mueller report it's kind of a politically toxic topic for people like Democrats coming from red districts, districts that were flipped, where, you know, talking about the Mueller report just isn't something that is going to be appealing to constituents there. So leaving it out was, you know, I think a way to make sure that House Democrats remain together on these articles of impeachment, that there's not a lot of rancor created among Democrats. So, you know, I think, of course, there are important legal issues, important constitutional issues that needed to be addressed, but overlaying that are these decisions that are political decisions about what to focus on for Democrats in order to stay pretty unified.
Quinta, how disappointed are you that Nancy Pelosi did not consult your feelings in making this decision and left all this material out? And when you read these two articles, what are the virtues and vices of them as you see them?
I'm disappointed, but I'm not that disappointed. I feel like, you know, a kid who didn't get to go to the zoo because it was raining, but there was kind of rain in the forecast anyway. It hasn't been, you know, hidden that the House was moving in this direction. So I sort of feel like I'm steeled for it. I do think, as Margaret says, it is important that the articles do, to some extent, incorporate by reference the fact that, in a sense, Trump is a repeat offender, right? That he's acting out a version of the same behavior here with Ukraine as he did in Russia, both in the sense of benefiting from election interference, abusing his power to turn the powers of a law enforcement apparatus, be it American or Ukrainian, against his perceived political enemies and then obstructing an investigation. And I do think that it is important that the House incorporates by reference the fact that these actions are consistent, in the House's words, with these past actions. I also, if I'm going to continue looking at the glass as if it's half full, I do think it's important to note that the articles frame this conduct as ongoing. So it's less pointing to past action that deserves punishment and more saying, look, he did this in the past, he's doing it now, and he's gonna do it again. And this is a matter of urgency for that reason. Partially, they make this point by pointing to the fact that the Democrats argue that the Ukraine matter is an effort to swing the 2020 U.S. election. And so the argument goes, we can't just sit around and wait. You can't say, well, we should wait to have an election to deal with this problem, because that's like saying, let's play another round of cards with the person who you just found out is cheating.
All right. So I want to defend Pelosi's decision here, because I think there's more to be said for it on the merits than, you know, merely having anticipated the disappointment, which is that this document has to actually support a trial. You know, it functions as an indictment, and you then have to tell the story that you're telling in this document in a Senate trial. And so if you're thinking about it, you're not just thinking about it as Margaret. If you're contemplating this document, you're not just thinking about it as to how it publicly communicates the story. You're also thinking about it as a trial document. And I think that, you know, I would love to see articles of impeachment that, you know, are really, you know, a capacious account of Trump's misconduct. On the other hand, if I'm Adam Schiff, I have to imagine actually taking that document and translating into a cognizable story at trial in the Senate under potentially hostile conditions, because 51 members of the Senate, 53 members of the Senate, are people that are associated with the party opposite your own, which is not normally something you deal with in either a jury pool or a judge. And so I do think there's something to be said for the simplicity and narrowness of this, as much as I am a little bit left cold by, as Margaret says, how much is not in it. So, Margaret, my question is, do you think as a trial matter, the simplicity is part of the ambition?
I definitely think so. You know, this isn't just a presentation for the jurors, who in this case are the senators. This is a presentation to the American public. They, in I think many ways that matter, are the most important sort of jurors on this. And so, you know, if Democrats are sort of looking not only to, okay, how does the trial turn out exactly, but also to, you know, how is this going to be framed going forward, even after the trial is over? It's really the American public, the ones that they need to sort of educate on this. So I do think telling a simple story at trial is much, much better than telling a complicated one. It's easier to prove the elements. It's easier to bring it alive. So I think it's definitely part of the strategy.
All right. So before we turn to the IG report, Margaret, just give us the next phase. What happens now? This stuff is moving real fast. We went from all day hearing with a lot of shouting to physical articles on paper in less than 18 hours. What happens next, and, you know, when does the next thing happen, and what do they look like?
So the next thing that happens is quite soon. It's Thursday, and I think it's been formally scheduled. The Judiciary Committee is going to have a markup of this resolution of these two articles of impeachment. And what that means is members of the Judiciary Committee will have a chance to offer amendments to this document. You know, the chairman may sort of clean up any little errors or whatever that are in there. So essentially, it will be Thursday, and it will also be a day of shouting.
Yeah, the markup is going to be ugly.
It will be ugly. It is unclear how long it will be. I mean, I suspect even if they start...
The gentlelady will suspend. I want to record a
point of order.
I'm going to filibuster right here. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are rules, obviously, when you're in a markup, but there's no limit, as far as I know, on the number of amendments that can be offered. And, you know, the chairman is just going to have to systematically work through all of those. There will be a lot of shouting, a lot of grandstanding. It may even not be concluded on Thursday. They may have to go into Friday. You know, I can see it being contentious, although, you know, it's hard to say exactly what tack the Republicans will take. I can't imagine they'll offer so many amendments themselves, but who knows? Maybe they will. It's going to be quite a day on Thursday, maybe even more shouty than the hearing from earlier this week.
Rave reviews in advance from Margaret Taylor. So thank you, Margaret, for joining us. And we are now joined by Jack Goldsmith and David Criss through the magic of Skype and other newfangled technologies. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
So, Quinta, give us, at a very high level of altitude, an overview of the Inspector General's report that was released yesterday on the advent of the Russia investigation, which is, of course, different from the Ukraine investigation.
Right. I think there are really two very, very high altitude top line takeaways. The first takeaway is there was not a witch hunt. There does not appear to have been a coup. The investigation, according to the Justice Department and Inspector General, into possible Russian interference in the 2016 election was properly predicated and did not depend on any kind of entrapment of George Papadopoulos or anything like that. It did not depend crucially on the Steele dossier, and there's no evidence that political bias on behalf of the FBI officials working the case affected it in any way. So that's the top line. And in that sense, the report was pretty devastating for the president and his allies, who have been arguing that there was a coup, a witch hunt, et cetera, et cetera. The second point, though, is much less of a rosy story, and this has to do with the specifics of the Carter Page FISA, which I should emphasize is not the same as an investigation into the Trump campaign. So the way that the Inspector General's report lays it out, the Page FISA is kind of an outgrowth of this larger concern about Russia, but it doesn't seem like anything in the larger Russia investigation was necessarily contingent on it. That said, the Inspector General identifies what on their face are a pretty concerning series of, I don't know what to call them, errors, misconduct, sloppiness on the part of line agents and attorneys at the FBI that essentially, Michael Horowitz argues, led to misrepresentations repeatedly being made in the material presented by the Justice Department to the FISC in arguing for first a FISA warrant on Carter Page and then for a renewal of that warrant. So insofar as Carter Page has been arguing that he is the victim of a grand plot by the Justice Department, it does not seem like that is true. But it is true that Carter Page has some justification in being kind of pissed off.
All right. So, David, you oversaw the FISA process at Justice in your capacity at NSD as head of NSD, but also when you were in the deputy's office, you had a lot of interactions with it. And I have gone back and forth with myself over the last 24 hours or so as to where this kind of misconduct falls on the spectrum. So on the one hand, you know, you can look at it and say, look, if you do a forensic investigation retroactively of any super complex FBI investigation, you're going to find all kinds of mistakes. These are human institutions. And so you go back and you look at the process by which a FISA is procured and then renewed three times, and you're going to find some mistakes. And so that's what Michael Horowitz did, and that's what he found. And
None of them seems to be intentional, or at least most of them don't seem to be intentional. And it's not clear that they affected the ultimate integrity of the applications. On the other hand, I look at it and I say, wow, this is a process that I am constantly assured is pristine, is really well scrubbed, gets a lot of attention. And the amount of mistakes in FISA applications should be pretty damn close to zero. Not that every lead pans out, but that the number of times that relevant facts are not included or relevant material is misstated or the Justice Department isn't fully or the FBI isn't fully forthcoming with the court about its information, it should be really close to zero. And this is not zero, it's 17 times. And so I kind of go back and forth about how outraged to be about this. So I'm curious for your thoughts, how big a problem we'll come to the vindication component of it in a moment, but how bad is the bad stuff?
The first thing to say is it's not political, as we've just finished discussing. And given the attention that's been paid to that, that should be said a million or two times before we get into anything else. So let's just assume I've said a million times that it's not the kind of political thing. Having said that, I'm pretty clear in my own mind that the errors here are not routine. Any complex investigation, as you say, has imperfections, and those will be discovered if you subject it to a really thorough proctological exam with massive time and resources available, and you look at a million documents and interview 70 people and so forth. But these errors are more significant than that. And I hope and I expect that when the IG does his broader audit of compliance with the Woods internal FBI accuracy procedures in U.S. person FISA cases, that he will find that this case is a bit of an outlier. These errors are more significant, in my view, even though not political, than what you would expect in a well-handled FISA. And I have some ideas about why that might be so, some more concrete, some more speculative, but I do think it is worse non-routine errors.
Jack, well, how surprised were you by the nature of the criticism? I mean, you were in various tweets in the weeks running up to this. You expressed some concerns about how severe the Horowitz report was likely to be and whether it was going to end up being a game changer. So when you look at the combination of criticism and clearing, do you see it as in any sense game changing? Do you see it as muddying? How do you understand the relative balance of vindication for the Bureau and severe criticism of the Bureau?
So I'd like to make a prior comment first based on what y'all said, and that is Horowitz didn't say that the motivation wasn't political, and he did for the errors, and he didn't say that they weren't intentional. I'm not sure how y'all can conclude that. What he said was that he found no documentary or testimonial evidence to support that it was political. But he also said that he didn't have any good explanations for all those errors either, and he wasn't able to figure out why they occurred. So until we drill down and we really don't know the details of what happened or why, I don't think we can conclude quite with the certitude that y'all just said that this wasn't political or purposeful. I just don't think he said that. He said he couldn't find testimonial evidence or documentary evidence saying it was political, but he definitely didn't say that it wasn't political, and he said he had no good explanations for it. So that's the first thing I would say. Ben, I don't know how to assess how this will play in Washington and whether it's a game changer or not. I don't pay attention to the details of enough attention to the details of how what the expectations are and how this is being set up. I will say this. It was much worse than I thought it was going to be. And to David's point that he hopes this is an outlier, one would have thought, and the Inspector General said this, one would have thought that in this super high-profile context, and the stakes could not be higher, and which there's some evidence, at least on the DOJ side, that there was extra scrutiny of what was going on here, as opposed to the FBI side. One would have thought that the Bureau would have been over backwards to make this process scrupulously perfect. And to have this many errors and really material omission after material omission, it's very, very hard to explain. And I can't gauge how it impacts Trump and Washington and those fights, but I think it's a disaster for the FISA process and for the Bureau, because David, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is the most intensive. There have been several investigations by the FISA court, I think, and by the Inspector General in the past. I think this is the most intensive investigation maybe ever of a FISA application process. And as I say, in this most crucial of contexts, when you would have expected them to do their very best and have their A team out and their A process out, there's just a huge breakdown in the honest representation of the facts. And the entire process, as I understand it, depends on the FBI giving the Justice Department, so it can get the FISA court, all the material information, including exculpatory information and information that cuts the other way. So I think, again, not in the context of Washington politics, but in the context of what the three of us have referred to as intelligence under law, I think this is a disaster for FISA, and I think it's not good for the FBI.
David, what do you think is it that I mean, that's a strong presentation of the case. Do you regard it as that bad? And is Jack right that there are no previous highly detailed examinations of individual Title I FISAs that we can hold this against and say, well, wait a minute, maybe this is an outlier?
As I said, I think this is very significant. I'm not sure I have quite the degree of concern that Jack is expressing, but that may be more of a quibble, given the relative scale of things here. I do think these are very bad. This is one of the most difficult and fraught investigations the FBI has ever done, and the FISAs were correspondingly difficult, I'm sure. Other FISAs have been given a pretty hard scrub in the past, sometimes by the IG, sometimes by the court itself. I recall, for example, the opinion of the FISA court in 2001, refusing to tear down the FISA wall, in which they noted a series of inaccuracies that caused them to be very, very concerned and express themselves in a public opinion. So there have been some prior examinations, but I doubt that there have been too many that have been as fraught as this one, both in the FISA itself and in the after action review. And the IG's report here is extremely broad and thorough. It's described that way, 170 interviews, 100 witnesses, a million documents. We know from Mr. Durham that there may be stuff in other agency files, but I do think this review was pretty thorough, and I do think it's significant that he didn't find any evidence of political motivation, particularly the way he's dealt with Strzok and Page issues in the past. So I agree with Jack's first point up to a point, but I wouldn't want to say that it means nothing, what the IG said about political motivations. It would have been very profound had he found evidence of political motivation and bias here, and he didn't after looking pretty hard. You never know whether you've turned over every stone. But so I think this was a very tough case. I think it had a lot of features in the way the investigation was structured that were not ideal, some of which I think were designed to protect against a disclosure of the sort that occurred in other investigations of other presidential candidates. And I hope that this will not prove the major disaster for the program that Jack is portending. But I think a lot depends on that subsequent audit that the IG is going to do.
Yeah, I also think, if I can go back to my original comments about the findings on political bias, because I think, Jack, you make a good point. It is important to be precise here. You're certainly right that regarding the 17 significant errors Horowitz identifies, he does say, you know, he doesn't know. It's not clear why they took place. I do think it's important to underline, however, that Horowitz does say explicitly that he found no evidence of bias in how the Crossfire Hurricane team handled confidential human sources, which has been one of the big bones that the president and some of his allies have had to pick. There's no evidence of political bias in either Peter Strzok or Lisa Page's handling of the investigation, in part because Page was not actually very much involved at all. And he also writes that they did not find documentary or testimonial evidence that political bias or improper motivation influenced the FBI's decision to seek FISA authority on Carter Page. So, well, you know, I don't want to speak to, you know, every flub, and David is certainly right that you never know what's under, you know, the rock that you might not have seen, but Horowitz did turn under a lot of rocks, and I think it is notable how definitive he is on these specific areas of contention.
Jack?
So, again, let me just emphasize a few things. First, I'm not suggesting that there was political bias, and Horowitz didn't find any evidence of it. I'm not saying that he did. And I think the most important thing, and I think this isn't actually surprising, because the predication to open an investigation, the standard is pretty forgiving, that there was an obvious case for opening the investigation when they did, based on the Papadopoulos information. And he found that that was proper, and he found nothing untoward in that. And I believe that the FBI, given what it was facing and hearing in the spring of 2016, would have been remiss not to open an investigation on the basis of that. I just want to emphasize, though, I was just emphasizing the point about the 17 errors. He said he didn't find evidence of bias, but he said he didn't have a good explanation for it either. And it's very hard for me to understand something untoward was going on. I mean, there are 17 material omissions. That's not quite right. There are 17 mistakes, all cutting in one direction in the Carter Page application. I think all 17 of them, maybe not all of them, but many of them concerned with holding pertinent information from DOJ and the FISA court. And it's just very hard for me to come up with a benign explanation for that. It doesn't, and he didn't seem to think that, he didn't say that there was or wasn't one, but he was disappointed in not having a good explanation for it.
And so I have the beginnings of several possible explanations, none of which I want to offer as the single or in combination as the whole story of why. But that, Ben, you've been puzzling over how bad it is. I sort of concluded it's pretty bad and have been puzzling over why and how it happened. And I have some ideas I'm happy to offer up, with the caveat that, you know, I'm still reading and these are still tentative and I don't pretend that they are authoritative.
The caveats will be entered into the record.
Thank you. So first of all, this investigation was structured in an unusual way for FBI, I think principally because they really wanted to keep it on close hold. They did not want this investigation to become public. And so what they did, as I understand it from reading the report, is they set it up as an investigation run out of headquarters instead of out of a field office, which is the normal approach. And they rotated in groups of agents on detail on 90-day terms, and then they would bring in a new set. Well, headquarters has many wonderful virtues at FBI. For one thing, the building is absolutely beautiful aesthetically.
Just for those listeners who have never actually seen the FBI building, it is the single ugliest building in Washington.
But it does have, I don't mean to denigrate headquarters, but it's not routine and it's not well equipped to run an investigation. It's not quite as bad as if you asked like somebody like me to go do a witness interview, but it's definitely not playing to the strength of the skill set. And it deviates from normal structures. And rotating agents every 90 days is weird. I get why they did it, but I do think that's part of what distorted this. And the overriding desire to keep this on close hold, you know, may have at the margins influenced the sort of, you know, cross-checking and sharing that would normally be encouraged. Again, I don't want to overstate it, but I think that's one factor. Another one is, this thing was fraught, it was tense, and it was, I think, probably conducted under very extreme time pressure. In a way, it had more of a terrorism tempo than a traditional counterintelligence tempo. It's actually interesting, apropos of what Jack said earlier and what Quinta was saying about the basis for opening. You know, had a friendly foreign intelligence service or foreign government come to us and said, you know, there's a U.S. person that has made a statement that he's involved with, you know, foreign jihadis to engage in a terrorist act, I mean, everybody would have been up on their hind legs to activate a massive investigation right away, and no one would have any doubts. Here, the allegations pertain to sort of covert action and election interference. But I mean, if you want to ask yourself, should they, would they open an investigation under their standards, which are the same for CI and CT? You know, I think the answer is yes, and I think Horowitz is right the way he describes it. But this had a CT tempo, but it was run by CI agents. They're not used to that operational tempo, and that may have been a factor as well. And I suppose a last factor, which is maybe the most controversial, is just, you know, how disorienting it may have been for all of them, from the highest to the lowest levels, to encounter in full flower right away in classified settings or in briefings or whatever, the characteristics of the Trump campaign and Trump officials, people like Mike Flynn and Paul Manafort and George Papadopoulos, not to mention Carter Page, who is, you know, an odd guy, I think. You know, those of us who are looking at things now and in the context of the impeachment discussion that was at the first part of this, you know, have had a long time now to get used to the rising temperature in the water. But these people, in a way, came face to face with the boiling water from day one. And I think it may have thrown them for a loop. It's not an excuse. It's not a justification. And I'm not even sure it's really part of this. But as I grope for an explanation as to why this occurred that doesn't involve just outright shoddy, sloppy negligence across the whole FISA program, and it's possible that that's what it is, we'll see. Those are some of the things that occur to me that made this investigation and this situation a little different than a more routine one.
Thanks to Grammarly for supporting the Lawfare podcast. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. It encourages everyone, even the best students, top professionals, and the very best national security law blog editors to do their best work and accomplish even more of their goals. So Grammarly is a writing assistant that I use to make myself look and sound smarter, and I honestly didn't think I needed a writing tool for that purpose. And you too will be surprised. You'll easily improve yourself and your communication at school, work, and almost anywhere with Grammarly. So as I say, I thought I didn't need anything like this, but I have come to use Grammarly to help me quickly reply to emails without embarrassing mistakes. And it turns out I make a bunch of embarrassing mistakes. I love how Grammarly spots the errors and offers helpful suggested changes. Just today, I learned that Brigade does not have two G's in it, only one. You know, it was in a tweet and just instinctively typed two G's, and who knew? I can rifle through my inbox more quickly and, you know, my tweets more quickly and more confidently with Grammarly on my side. Grammarly helps people show their best self through writing and is available across platforms, including an online browser extension, a desktop editor, and a mobile keyboard checker. Grammarly is available on Chrome, Firefox, Safari, and Edge browsers, and on platforms like iOS, Android, Windows, and Mac. The free product reviews critical spelling and grammar, and Grammarly Premium looks out for spelling and grammar, plus advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, and readability for different occasions, like a business proposal, an academic essay, or a lengthy Lawfare essay. So accomplish your goals with help from Grammarly. Stop making email typos on your phone. Polish your resume to get that new job. I should know better than to make so many mistakes, and I didn't even realize I was making them all. But when I'm writing fast, and I do write fast, Grammarly keeps me in safe territory. So use Grammarly and personalize your experience. You can change the settings to write for different occasions, like school, work, or Lawfare writing. Grammarly can remember new words, too, and it can help you spell brigade correctly. Go to grammarly.com/lawfare to get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. That's Grammarly, grammarly.com/lawfare for 20% off your Grammarly premium account. So, David, before we move on, we've got a lot of other material to cover, but before we move on, I want to ask you about what you just assumed away, which is, you know, people like you
and for that matter, people like me, have been arguing for a lot of years that the FISA process is this one that gets a lot of review and, you know, a lot of care, and the FBI takes a lot of care, and it's a process that we all should have a lot of pride in, and it's kind of government at its best. And one of the other possible explanations for this is that actually we've been wrong this whole time, and Edward Snowden has been right, or at least he's been a little bit more right than we gave him credit for. And in fact, the process is a little bit more of a rubber stamp than people like you and me have been propagating in the world. And that actually, if you turn over rocks in any investigation, you're going to find FBI agents behaving like cops. And if you read Jack's book about Jimmy Hoffa and his stepdad, you see a lot of agents behaving. You see some agents behaving in incredible ways, but you also see some agents, you know, behaving in ways that wouldn't surprise Michael Horowitz after conducting this investigation. And so I guess one question I have is, you know, maybe the explanation isn't anything particular about this investigation. It's actually just that the normal process isn't as good as we think it is.
Yeah, I think, as I said, these errors, as documented by Horowitz, are worse than normal. That doesn't mean the process, when it isn't subject to the special stresses that were applicable here, is always pristine. I do think, in general, if you look at any complex, fast-moving, high-stakes, high-stress process under a microscope after the fact, you will find errors. Turn over all the rocks, you're going to find some worms. That's always the case. But these worms found here, I think, are worse than you would normally find. You know, the FISA process is like any other process engaged in by humans. It's not like you fix it and it's done and then everything's fixed and you move on. It's a process. It's subject to cultural and procedural renewal. It waxes and wanes from time to time and due to various factors. So, you know, it may have degraded since I last took a hard look at it. I don't like to think that, but I, you know, certainly have to acknowledge the possibility. My first instinct is to look for factors about this investigation that make it special and that may account for errors here that turn out to be special. But as I say, the broader audit, I think, will be a good litmus test of sort of whether this is an outlier for whatever reasons or whether, in fact, the process just isn't as good as we thought or think that it is.
I just want to say one more thing about what Horowitz said, and because there are other structural problems here that were no fault of the people making the decisions. And that was, and I don't think it's the fault of anyone. It's just a matter of inadequate foresight. But the Inspector General time and time again expressed surprise that the DIOG and the Attorney General guidelines didn't provide for more robust scrutiny and maybe for heightened standards, if not heightened process, and certainly DOJ sign-off for investigations into members of an election campaign because of the political sensitivities, because of First Amendment concerns, just because of the traditional concern that the Bureau would, going back to Hoover, would engage in surveillance actions that had a political valence. So I think that some of the problems here were just classic inadequate guidance by the bureaucracy and the rules. And so people in the very tense situation David was describing were looking at guidance that didn't provide much guidance and making discretionary calls, which may look worse in retrospect than they did at the time, and also which they probably should have had more guidance on some of this stuff. And I'm sure this is one of the important parts of this report are the recommendations at the end, which FBI Director Wray said he's taking seriously. So there's already significant reform in the works.
All right, let's talk about Bill Barr, because the Attorney General, in a fashion that I think is, at least in my adult lifetime of following the Justice Department, is, I'm quite certain, unique in an AG's response or any agency's response to an investigation by an IG of his own agency. concluded and issued a statement to the effect that not that the IG had been too tough on his agency, but that the IG had been insufficiently tough on his agency. So first of all, Quinta, what did the Attorney General say about this investigation, and what is the manner in which he characterized the investigation and its findings, and to what extent do you regard the Attorney General's statement as accurate?
So Bill Barr announced that the report, quote, makes clear that the FBI launched an intrusive investigation of a U.S. presidential campaign on the thinnest of suspicions that, in my view, were insufficient to justify the steps taken. It is also clear that, from its inception, the evidence produced by the investigation was consistently exculpatory. So Barr's takeaway is, perhaps not surprisingly, very critical of the Russia investigation. I would argue that his view of the report is similar to his view of the Mueller report, the difference being that in this case, he made his statement afterward, not ahead of time. But there's a similar carefulness with wording, I guess I'll say. He doesn't say that the investigation was improperly predicated. He doesn't say that there was spying or that there was a coup, but he strongly hints that that is his view.
But he does say that there was spying on a presidential campaign, which is not what the report finds, right? I mean, the report finds that they predicated investigations on four individuals. And it is quite careful to describe a conduct that was properly predicated as to those four individuals. It does not describe a highly intrusive investigation of a campaign. And what am I missing?
So perhaps if we have Bill Barr in the room, he might say that he's defining campaign more broadly, right? But that's kind of my point, is that he's slicing the words unbelievably fine here in order to look at the words on the page and just draw a conclusion that is completely different from the conclusion that I've expressed and Ben, that you just expressed. And so in that respect, perhaps it isn't surprising, since this is a repeat performance. I think it is disappointing to see this continued behavior in the Attorney General. And there's an additional layer where he is siding with the Inspector General against his own Department of Justice, which I understand is a pretty unusual thing for an Attorney General to do. So in all those ways, it is a noteworthy statement, let's say.
All right. So, Jack, you and I were initially enthusiastic about, or I'm not quite sure enthusiastic, but encouraged by Bill Barr's appointment. You remained a bit more admiring of him than I did. And you have, you know, regarded him as somebody who is trying to defend the prerogatives of the executive branch. I'm curious how you read this statement. Is there a construction of it that is less objectionable than it seems to me?
I did not like the statement. I did not think it was worthy of the Attorney General in this very fraught context for the country. He's clearly convinced that there was a concerted effort during the Obama administration and thereafter to engage in illegitimate actions from inside and outside the government against this president. He clearly believes that, and he's been saying that, and this statement is his reading of the Horowitz Inspector General report through that lens. I don't think it is remotely helpful for him to basically put these things in political and antagonistic terms the way he does. There's a way to read the statement where it's technically not inaccurate. But if you look at the difference between his statement and Ray's statement, Ray says,
right,
Ray summarized the investigation. He said he accepts the results. He said he took responsibility. He said he's going to try to do better. And he listed the things he was trying to do. That would have been the appropriate thing for Barr to do. Barr has the most unusual statement yesterday with Durham, and we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to Durham separately. Let's deal with Barr first.
Yeah, but let me just say, Barr has apparently, and foreshadowing Durham, he has reason to think that there's more relevant information here. And he's been hinting at this for many, many, many months. And that's fine. There may be more relevant information. I think it's perfectly legitimate for Durham to be conducting his investigation. Durham is a credible guy. But Barr is consistently painting, foreshadowing conclusions in a tendentious way. I think it would have been better for him to say nothing, let Durham make his extraordinary statement if he wants to. But I did not think it was a helpful statement for the Justice Department.
I think Barr, it's interesting to look at Barr, and I know him, and I know he's, you know, a first-class mind. He's terribly, terribly smart, much smarter than most of the people. He really, I think, sees himself as a political advocate for the office of the presidency and hence for its current occupant. And I think on the sort of spectrum of attorneys general over my lifetime anyway, he's more willing to engage in that kind of political advocacy than, I don't know, say as a comparison, Janet Reno, who may have been at the other extreme. And I think, as Jack says, there may be a couple, maybe three reasons for this. One is a more cynical interpretation, which is just he is a political advocate. And as some people have accused him in context of the Mueller report, he's just providing a counterpoint or distraction for the news media to take away from the sort of devastating impact of the first political related findings by Horowitz. Second, I do think he may be banking on or have reason to believe that Durham is going to find something at some other agency, because that's the key point that Durham seemed to be making, that is at least optically valuable for the president's narrative here. You can imagine Pete Strzok, Lisa Page style stuff, even if it didn't have any connection to anything operational, coming through. Because again, I think when you know, intelligence officials were first confronted with the full flower of the Trump administration, they may have, you know, been freaked out a little bit, and they may have said so. And third, I wonder if in particular, and this will be important, whether there is evidence, say, that the CIA put the Australians up to tipping the bureau on the Papadopoulos conversation. That to me would be the most interesting operational thing if the evidence showed that.
Okay, so let's come to that, because I think there's a variety of interesting scenarios to play out in light of Durham's statement. But let's start with Durham's statement. So Quinta, first of all, what did John Durham have to say about this report? And remind us, for those listeners who are at this point lost in a sea of names, who is John Durham and why does anybody give rat's patootie about what he had to say about the Inspector General's report?
John Durham is the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut. He has somehow ended up in this sort of odd position of being the guy that the Justice Department calls in to investigate the Justice Department when it doesn't want the Inspector General to do that particular job for it. So,
in national security.
In national security cases, exactly, which is – it's a very, very specific specialty. So in this case, he was tapped by Bill Barr to look into the origins of the Russia investigation, and the scope of his investigation included, unlike the Inspector General's investigation, looking at other agencies of the U.S. government. The chief one that's going to spring to mind here, obviously, is the CIA. So he has been conducting that investigation sort of in the background while everything else has been going on. And he's been quiet, in fact. He hasn't said anything. And so it's very notable that in response to the report yesterday, he put out this statement basically saying that, you know, he has great respect for Horowitz's office, but, and I'll quote, "our investigation has included developing information from other persons and entities, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. Based on the evidence collected to date, and while our investigation is ongoing, last month we advised the Inspector General that we do not agree with some of the report's conclusions as to predication and how the FBI case was opened."
All right. So I guess the first issue there is, I think, the easiest one, which is, can anybody think of a prior case in which in a pending matter involving national security, or for that matter, not involving national security, a U.S. attorney or a senior Justice Department official comes forward and says, look, we've got a pending matter, but, you know, we don't agree with X. Like, I'm not going to say very much, but I am going to say that, you know, I don't agree with this other investigation. I cannot think of such a statement in the past. Can any of you?
I cannot. And it's extraordinary for that reason. And it's also extraordinary coming from Durham, who in his other investigations in these areas has been completely closed-mouthed during the investigation, famously so.
Right, and takes a long time and says nothing along the way.
Right. So the fact that he felt compelled to speak out, I don't know whether Barr nudged him or he thought it was important for some reason. There's another thing I don't understand, which is what the question of the predication to open the investigation. The argument Horowitz made is pretty straightforward. I mean, it's a low threshold, and the threshold was met both legally and factually. So I'm having a hard time even imagining what he would find that would call into question the predication.
That's my speculation about the CIA putting the Aussies up to it.
Yeah. So let me tee that up for a minute, because for listeners who don't think about predication issues, the predication requirement is a requirement, a regulatory requirement, a normative prudential requirement, that in order to open investigation, you have to have a certain threshold of information that reaches a certain quantum of information in order to open the investigation in the first place. And that is called the predicate and the predication of the investigation. One predicates an investigation based on information that one has, not on the basis of information that one doesn't have. And so there is something a little bit odd about, you know, Mike Horowitz saying, okay, I have reviewed a million pages of documents and concluded that the FBI took no investigative steps before it got this information from the friendly foreign government, which everybody in the world except Mike Horowitz will concede is the Australians, and that the friendly foreign government gives this information. The FBI had taken no investigative steps before that. They predicated it based on that, and that is when it happened in August. The information came in July 2016. The investigation is predicated in August 2016. So what Durham appears to be saying, David, is I have information resulting from my jurisdiction over entities outside the Justice Department that calls into question the predication. And my question to you is, how could that possibly be true, given that Durham, what is the scenario in which the FBI gets its first information in July, according to the report, predicates the investigation in August and has taken no step before that? What is the situation in which they could have had no predication, given that the information that they got was adequate to predicate the investigation? How could Durham's statement possibly be correct?
I gave you my best Twilight Zone guess at it.
So walk us through that.
The theory would be a radical, a theory anyway, would be a truly radical Five Eyes conspiracy in which the CIA is out to get Trump. This is Twilight Zone stuff, and launders its effort to manipulate the FBI into launching an investigation by persuading the Australians or whatever friendly foreign government, as you say, to tip the Bureau to a completely fake, made-up idea. This would be a terrific Robert Ludlum novel. I don't think it's terribly likely, but that's the kind of thing, it seems to me, Durham's going to have to find to pay off on the remarks and the promissory notes that he and Bill Barr have uttered. And I do think his statement, if I can just say, I mean, it's doubly weird. First, it's really odd to talk about one ongoing investigation before it's complete in response to another that is complete. And I do wonder, as Jack does, did Barr give him a nudge or what prompted him to speak in that unusual way. Second thing is, you'd think that, frankly, that Durham and Horowitz were coordinating fully. I mean, if I were Horowitz, and it's certainly routine IG practice to sort of say, anybody got anything that they want to throw in? Now, maybe that happened, and you can see some guarded language in Horowitz's report that says, hey, we're only looking at the Bureau, not the other agencies. But it's still just weird that, like, that didn't get baked into the report itself. So it's doubly strange, in my view, what's going on. And I think Durham, you know, is either going to find evidence of distaste and extreme distaste for Trump, which would not, frankly, be terribly surprising in other agencies, or Trump's folks, or the way they behaved, or the way they failed to safeguard classified information. I think that's less worrisome. And if he finds the Australian Ludlam conspiracy, that would be grotesquely worrisome and of the first order of concern. But I am not holding my breath for that to be found.
Jack?
May I ask a question for you, David?
Yeah.
Just to drill down, I don't remember all the details, but don't we know that Papadopoulos made a suggestion to the Australian contact? Or are you suggesting that that might have been made up? I don't even understand how, on your theory, what could, even in the twilight zone, the CIA have done that would render the predication from Papadopoulos illegitimate?
I'm writing it up in the screenplay now, and you'll see it in Hollywood. I mean, I'm straining, so don't judge me too harshly. But the way this information came into the Bureau, it came in through LEGAT in the foreign FBI LEGAT in the friendly foreign country. All right, and so that came presumably from the Foreign Service, that a representative of which apparently was the person who heard Papadopoulos say these things. Well, I don't know. Could CIA have, you know, corruptly leveraged the Australian service to feed a false tip to the LEGAT, knowing that that would find its way to headquarters and trigger an opening of an investigation? I mean, I see. That's the idea, or something like that. In other words, what I'm really trying to say is, if you find evidence of distaste or disgust or dismay at the presence of Trump and his transition team and Mike Flynn being sloppy and talking on an open cell phone or stuff like that, that's one thing. I can get that. What you need, and what I think Durham needs to be able to show in order to make what he said and what Barr said sort of anything more than puffery, is an operational consequence of some sort that follows from that. That's what they didn't find when they looked at the text messages of Strzok and Page, and they didn't even find the text messages on this investigation. So I'm just trying to look at Durham and Barr's statements through the lens of what Durham might find as compared to what Horowitz has found in his two reviews.
So one thing that some really terrible story like that, and something like that would be terrible for many, many reasons, and that something like that would explain, and I'm not, again, we're now in real speculation land, but it would explain Barr's really extraordinary confidence that there was wrongdoing in 2016. And he hinted at that and hinted at that and hinted at that. And then we see Durham saying this. So it just makes me think that there's some blockbuster down the road. Who knows?
Quinta.
It's interesting you say that, Jack, because I think that that's kind of been the loop that we've been stuck in for years now. You know, that there's always this hope, whatever your political affiliation is, or even if you have no political affiliation, that, you know, the next report is going to be the one that just blows the lid off the whole thing, right? So there was the Inspector General report on the Clinton email investigation, and then there was the Mueller report, and now we have this report, and then at some point there's going to be the Durham report, and then who knows, you know, maybe someone will investigate the Durham investigation.
We'll have the Quinta-Jurassic investigation of the Durham investigation of the Horowitz
exactly.
investigation.
Exactly. It's turtles all the way down.
Turtles all the way down.
Exactly. So I really do think that, you know, part of that is a media environment that is primed to make things splashy. And part of that, honestly, is the president and the fact that he is not only willing to lie about what different documents contain, he was
basically wasted no time before flat out lying about how the Inspector General report vindicated everything he'd said about there being a coup, but also, you know, sort of shamelessly jumping from conspiracy theory to conspiracy theory. So if one theory isn't vindicated by one report, who cares? On to the next one, and sort of down you go. And that's depressing on the one hand, but I do think there is a very specific consequence relevant to what we've been discussing here, which is that insofar as the Horowitz report raises serious questions about the FISA process within the FBI, no one is going to end up talking about that outside the, you know, the bureau itself, outside government. All the media attention is going to be on, you know, what happened with the Australians? Maybe there really was a conspiracy. What was the CIA up to? What was John Brennan's nefarious plot? And as a result, there's not going to be discussion about the actually serious issues about how the FISA process works. And that's a real shame.
Yeah, can I jump on that a sec? I do want to just say one thing is I feel a little irresponsible having played out my screenplay, Twilight Zone thing. I mean, because in the current environment, God knows somebody will take it out of context. And it's
David
bad
Chris,
there.
Former head of the FISA process, right. Admits please. There was a conspiracy.
Kill me now. And I do think Quinta's point is it makes me want to just say, look, I was doing that through the lens of what would it take in actual evidence to make what Barr and Durham said and did, you know, understandable and not really weird. And that's what led to a really weird speculation, which I don't want to be irresponsible. And, you know, I don't want to feed that beast. So I, you know,
David, you're among friends here. We and the 50,000 listeners of this podcast all understood exactly what you meant. And so all tweets accusing you of hatching a conspiracy theory should be ignored.
I'm grateful for the advance absolution, Ben. Thank you.
And we are going to leave it there. Guys, it's Lawfare Podcasts all the way down, because tomorrow Mike Horowitz himself is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we will bring you the patented Lawfare podcast, No Bull Podcasts, just the questions and just the answers. So if this discussion hasn't given you enough sense of the warring components of the Michael Horowitz report, the Crossfire Hurricane report, tune in tomorrow. And it may be late at night by the time we finish editing it, but you'll enjoy all the questions and all the answers as Horowitz faces the committee with No Bull. And with that, thank you, Margaret, who's already gone, Quinta, David, and Jack for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and we got to wrap this podcast up so that I can go to the Brookings holiday party. Thanks this week to the Brookings Institution for having an awesome holiday party. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast and the Brookings Institution. So tweet about us, share us on Facebook, review us on whatever podcast distribution service you use, and I want you to pin us on Pinterest. It's merch season. The holidays are coming up. The Lawfare store is there for you people. TheLawfareStore.com. We have pens. We have notebooks. We have hoodies. We have Rational Security merchandise. We have Lawfare merchandise. We have The Report merchandise. We have all kinds of merch. And you're going to go buy it. We have coins. We have challenge coins. So go do it. Our music is, of course, performed by Sophia Yan. Our audio engineer this episode is the long-suffering Michaela Fogel. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell, who held off on posting an earlier podcast to bring you this special episode in real time today. So send a tweet to Jen Patya Howell thanking her. And, of course, thanks for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.